like a rock. I was strong as I could be, like a rock. Nothing ever got to me, like a rock.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We like to think of popular music as an authentic voice of and for the people, an expression from the heart. And it has been that, plus a big business, we know. But ever since radio and TV moved in, companies with things to sell have heard music as the way to our emotions and our pocketbooks. Marketing and music have grown so close, says my guest today, that it can be hard to tell the difference. This hour on Point, how the advertising age came to popular music. You can join the conversation. Think of your favorite songs. Think of the jingles rattling around your head. Have those two playlists merged? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Timothy Taylor. He's a professor of ethnomusicology at UCLA's Herb Alpert School of Music. His new book is The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Timothy Taylor, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's good to be with you, Tom.
So there we are, right behind us. We've got Bob Seger, and we're thinking pickup trucks.
Yeah, that's right. Pickup trucks and, you know, the great sound of an all-American voice, Bob Seger.
And put to work, as so many others have been, in the service of selling. Bob Dylan, Times They Are Changing, went to the Bank of Montreal in 1997, Beatles, Revolution, Nike ad, Rolling Stones, Start Me Up to Microsoft and Windows, Michael Jackson and Pepsi commercials, and on and on and on. Was this inevitable, Tim?
I don't think it was inevitable. I think, the advertising industry has become increasingly powerful, or at least increasingly influential on the everyday lives of Americans in the course of the 20th century. But the jingle was such a workhorse for so many decades that I don't know that anybody really thought that the jingle would die and would be replaced by existing popular music. I don't think most people saw that coming. There are a bunch of factors that made it possible, which you can talk about. But
And we will. There was a time when a lot of people did not see that coming. Bob Dylan did not see that coming. We've got sound. You talk about this in the book. But this is the 1965, the famous press conference, San Francisco. A reporter asks a young Bob Dylan if he would ever sell out. He laughed and answered like so.
Josh Duff Dunson, in his new book, Freedom in the Air, implies that you have sold out to commercial interests and the topical song movement. Do you have any comments here?
Well, no comments, no arguments. No, I certainly don't feel guilty.
If you were going to sell out to a commercial interest, which one would you choose?
Bob?
Ladies' garments.
If you were going to sell out, what would you sell out for? Ladies' garments. Flash forward, 2004, sure enough, an aging Bob Dylan selling ladies' garments for Victoria's Secret.
I see silhouettes in the window.
Bob Dylan for ladies' garments, undergarments, no less. Timothy Taylor is with us. His new book is The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. Tim, you write in here that there's been a lot made over the years, and Bob Dylan's music would have been right at the heart of this, of the resistant and even liberatory aspects of popular culture, popular music. Popular music, especially in the Dylan era, was seen as kind of raising, you know, the interest of the common man, resistant to the man, the power. I guess that was no small part of the reason that people at one time did not think that popular music would fall completely into this marketing realm.
Yeah, that's true, especially rock and roll. I mean, rock and roll was the rebellious soundtrack for a couple of generations, and it was anti-commercial, at least much of it. It was to the extent that it was part of the counterculture, it was anti-consumer culture, and I don't think anybody thought during this, at least the 60s, that it would be used for what it's now used for.
And yet, here we are. We'll look at just how that merger has happened. You trace it all the way back to the dawn of radio and its popularization. The Fleischmann's Yeast Hour, a big example here. This was 1929, 1936. NBC had a huge variety show. Starred crooner Rudy Vallee, paid for and named after Fleischmann's Yeast.
Mother Nature knows her stuff. Mother Nature's hard to bluff. She makes her plan, and Mr. Man may try to change it, but he never can.
In our endless search for you, let us face that simple truth that nature can't be fooled. And she has wisely ruled that life begins at sweet 16. Suddenly, every Jack and Jill in it finds a thrill in it, love.
Timothy Taylor, we can almost see the feet tapping there in 1930 or 1931, whatever it was. I mean, the music is fun, but of course it's wrapped right away in the push to sell, in this case, yeast. Was that, did folks find that strange then, or did they associate music already with products? I mean, peddlers used to sing out in the streets, no doubt.
Yeah, you could push the history of music being used to sell goods probably, you know, as far back as recorded history goes, but and including in cheap music, songs like In My Merry Oldsmobile, which was from 1905, which was not written to sell Oldsmobiles, but Oldsmobile used it to sell Oldsmobiles. So people were fairly accustomed to it, and when radio burst on the scene in the 20s and really begins to become popular in the mid-20s, entire programs were usually sponsored by a single sponsor, and people didn't very much mind the fact that, you know, they had to listen to a pitch for yeast or anything else, because they thought they were getting free entertainment. So, you know, if it was wrapped up in a pretty musical package, that was okay.
You're right, and I found this really interesting, that what it did set off was a scramble among marketers and advertisers to figure out, maybe for the first time, what music Americans really wanted to hear in their mass.
Yeah, that was a huge question, because in the early days of radio, before there was the level of sophisticated polling that we now have, advertisers and advertising agencies had no idea what people were listening to, what people liked, so they devised endless schemes to try to figure out what people liked. And they did conduct a bunch of polls, but a lot of the ways that they found out about listener preferences were through sponsoring contests, giving away things, and doing everything they could to get listeners to write in and try to figure out what listeners wanted to hear. But what listeners wanted to hear didn't always go along with what an advertiser thought might be the best music to sell his or her product. So there were lots of arguments between sponsors and their advertising agencies about, you know, the best music to sell a product, and what did people really want, and is this thing called crooning ever going to become successful, or is this thing called crooning ever going to go away? So they're just endless debates in the early days.
And before you know it, we've got Bob Singer singing Like a Rock for Chevy Trucks. Ruth is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Ruth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got a funny story for you.
Okay.
We were driving through the mountains on our way to Asheville, North Carolina,
yeah,
and listening to an oldie station, and my 8-year-old woke up in the back seat and said, "Hey, Mom, they made a song out of that truck commercial."
Oh, my gosh.
And was it Bob Seger or something else? Do you remember, Ruth?
Yeah. It was playing Like a Rock, and he just recognized the tune and realized that, hey, that's a song. That's not the commercial.
I think you've put your finger right on it. That's funny. Out of the mouths of babes, 8 years old and 8 year olds in the back seat. I love that. Thank you, Ruth. I mean, Tim, that's kind of your point here, that these days we're not sure which way the door swings sometimes.
Yep, that's right. You know, you can turn on the radio and hear music and not be sure if it's a song or if it's a commercial.
And her son really not knowing which way it goes. Was there concern about this, or was music just seen as, hey, great way to sell products? Let's go Chiquita Bananas or whatever it may be. Let's just turn it on.
There wasn't much concern about it. Not until the rock era, when so much of rock music was predicated on the idea that it was rebellious and it was anti-commercial. But before then, musicians were, you know, happy to get on the radio by whatever means possible. You know, there was some fear that on some musicians' part that if they sang for too many products, they, you know, they would sort of lose credibility. But mostly they were happy to do it.
And the Mad Men crowd, they understood that music could take their message much deeper than just text or just vocalization.
Yeah, I mean, advertising executives, I mean, some of them were not very convinced that music could do much for them. They thought it was best used for selling products that weren't very different from each other. So if you're trying to sell Coke or Pepsi, then you really need music. But if your product was unique, then you didn't need music so much, according to that logic. But the guys at Sterling Cooper certainly knew that music could help them sell in ways that almost nothing else could.
Timothy Taylor's new book is The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. We'll look at that conquest. You can join us. Is your head a jukebox of jingles? I'd like to teach the world to sing and all the rest. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's Backseat Blues, a Ford commercial, 1958. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The 59 Ford's got room to spare. That is a Ford.
That is a Ford.
So before you spend your dough on a car, there's something you must know. How's the backseat? Test the backseat. Sit in the backseat, your passengers will. And you'll find it's really true. Ford is proportioned for people. Ford, Ford, Ford is proportioned for you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about music and commerce in America, how advertising has moved in on American popular music. Timothy Taylor is with us. He's professor of ethnomusicology, UCLA's Herb Alpert School of Music. His new book is The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. I don't want to step on Aretha Franklin saying things go better with Coca-Cola. Because boy, did she sing that, and a lot else, and a lot of other people sang it too. These days, you've got marketing all over American popular music. You must know the jingles of your, I'd like to teach the world to sing, you deserve a break today, like a good neighbor. Is it inevitable, music and marketing, and do you remember when selling songs to advertisers was considered selling out? Is that history now? Do you just assume catchy tunes will show up in ads? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Tim Taylor joins us from Culver City, California. A lot of people sang that one. Here's one more version of it. Johnny Cash, Pepsi-Cola flooded the airwaves with its You Got a Lot to Live, to Give jingle sung by all kinds of folks, from Odetta to Three Dog Night. Here, first, the man in black, Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash.
There's a whole new way of living. Pepsi helps supply the drive. It's got a lot to give to those who like to live, 'cause Pepsi helps them come alive.
It's Johnny Cash puts his back, his guitar, into a little Pepsi advertising there. That was 1970. Justin in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Justin, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see out there?
Well, what I was curious about was something more akin to what we see in television and movie advertising, which is product placement. And I'm just thinking about in hip-hop music how what started out as, you know, sort of shout-outs to different kinds of products and that kind of thing, that the person actually liked, how that's moving towards things that have been arranged or endorsed or those kind of things. And I was wondering what your guest knows or what kind of insights they have about that.
Tim Taylor, a lot of bling attention in all kinds of music, hip-hop in particular. What about the arrangements that lead to those product endorsements or, you know, just mentions that show up all over the place?
Yeah, well, product placement actually was sort of the early model of advertising because since a program is usually sponsored by a single company, their product would be, you know, in the show in some way. So it's kind of interesting that now when we talk about product placement as something new, it actually has an old history. But with respect to hip-hop, I mean, it's clear that, you know, the hip-hop notion about not selling out is not anything like the rock notion of selling out or not selling out. So hip-hop musicians have no problem whatsoever about mentioning favorite products, favorite brands, and using or letting their music be used in commercials at the same time. The idea that selling out is universal across popular music isn't really true. That was much more of a rock thing.
Of course, it did not, as you say, didn't start with hip-hop at all. Johnny Cash saying, "You've Got a Lot to Live." Roberta Flack saying, "You've Got a Lot to Live." A little more soulful. Here it is.
Roberta Flack.
There's a whole new way of living. Pepsi helps supply the drive. It's got a lot to give to those who like to live. This Pepsi helps them come alive.
Roberta Flack knew how to get her hooks in. I mean, it can sound frivolous, but there are actually big themes here, Timothy Taylor. You say that in the period that you look at it, when it began, let's say early radio days, that Americans' very sense of themselves, they sort of fashioned themselves around Victorian concepts of character, move forward to the end of this time, or now, and we are fashioning ourselves, our notion of ourselves, very often, you write, through the products we purchase, and music having played a big role in sort of wrapping it in emotion and psychological trappings that let us incorporate this as a sense of selves. Describe that evolution.
It's complex. It took much of the 20th century, but, you know, in the 19th century and into the early 20th century, you know, the concept of self was really a concept of this, as you say, this Victorian notion of character. You know, if you possessed character, then you were
honest, brave, courageous, true. I don't know, right on through.
Right. All of those things. But in the early 20th century, this begins to shift to a notion of personality, and a personality was something that you could actually fashion to some extent by buying, self-help books about working on your personality. You know, Dale Carnegie is famous.
Your presentation.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this lasted for quite a long time. I would say we're in a new phase now. But advertisers and marketers attempted, even early in the days of radio, to imbue products with personality also. And today we would talk about this in terms of branding, which is a sort of a much more complex, you know, notion of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Imbuing products with personality was a way to sell them, but, you know, it was also a way to convince people that, you know, if they owned these things, or, you know, that maybe some of that would rub off on them, or, you know, in the later phases of selling, that maybe, you know, if you bought a particular product, then you would be as cool as the people that you see using the product in TV commercials, which is a strategy that you can still see in TV commercials today. But it was a long, slow evolution to the notion that, you know, you possessed character and you could, you know, through, you know, church attendance and other things, you could improve your character. It's a long move from that to the notion that we are what we buy.
And the role that music played in lubricating that move?
It was often compelling. I mean, even in the early days of advertising, music could play a potent role in popularizing a product, getting people to go out and, you know, purchase something because of gratitude that, you know, they were getting free music on the radio and they liked what they heard, so they would go out and buy the product. This is in the days before there were standalone commercials like we now have, but with the standalone commercials, in some sense, they became even more powerful because they were meant to be, you know, short and memorable, and many of them could be extremely effective in getting people to, you know, remember the name of a product, remember information about the product, you know, and generations of Americans know not to put bananas into the refrigerator because of the Chiquita Banana jingle of 1944, because the lyrics in that in the first version, which they changed over time, but the lyrics in the first version tell you not to put bananas in the refrigerator. So they were catchy, they were memorable, they educated you about the product. You know, they could perform all kinds of roles.
Sometimes they would associate a product with a whole view of the world. Pepsi had its cash and flack. Coca-Cola came roaring back. It was the mamas and the papas. This was 1971. Big ad push in music. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey bees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Perfect harmony.
Perfect harmony.
I'd like to buy the world a home and keep it company.
Tim Taylor, what's going on there? This is not just Coke. You know, look at the bottle. I remember those ads. There were people standing on a hillside in bell bottoms.
Yeah, hillside in Italy, but not in this country.
Yeah.
But that was the culmination, or at least you know, the end of a chapter in what some people have called the Cola Wars. In the early 60s, executives at Pepsi realized that there was this whole baby boom generation, and they wanted to try to figure out how to capture the attention of that generation. And they started developing commercials that were supposed to do that, but if you listen to some of those early commercials, they don't sound like they're particularly youth-oriented. In fact, the first one was a kind of an updating of a song from the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But Pepsi got more and more adept at making commercials sound more and more like the popular music of the day. And their whole strategy was never to write a commercial or write advertising copy that said, buy our drink because it's better than Coke. Their strategy for decades was, our drink is, if you drink our drink and you're cooler than people who don't drink our drink.
Yeah.
Or you're part of the Pepsi generation, you know, you're in the in-group. Whereas Coke's strategy was a more old-fashioned one, being an older company. Its strategy was simply to say that, you know, buy our product, it's better. So Pepsi, through various commercials in the course of the 60s, tried in various ways to attract the attention of the youth market, writing commercials that were more and more pop music sounding. And that commercial from Coca-Cola that you just played from 1971 was the culmination of this Cola Wars. And marked the Coke sort of capitulation, Coke, you know, jumping on the youth bandwagon in a spectacularly successful way.
Coming over to the kind of worldview marketing, associate yourself with this. And all the while, the jingles still driving through all this. Timothy Taylor says in his book, The Sounds of Capitalism, all of it changing Americans' sense of themselves. Definitions of character to something like definitions by consumption, by what they bought. Ron Dante was in the middle of that jingle writing and wrote it right over into the popular music arena. American singer, songwriter, session vocalist, record producer, successful jingle performer and composer. 1969, rocketed to success as a pop musician, singing lead vocals on the Archies' Sugar Sugar, the number one selling record of the year and the top 10 single. Tracy joins us right now from Los Angeles. Ron Dante, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So you were selling all this stuff with music before you became on, you know, a big deal on the pop charts. How did you see your job in life as a jingle writer, Ron?
Well, actually, I was the jingle singer.
Okay.
I was the studio guy who sang all the commercials. In fact, I sang both for Coke and Pepsi on their big campaigns. You've Got a Lot to Live. I was on every one of those campaigns. Do you know that commercial is in the Smithsonian? It's so popular, and
yeah,
it defined a generation. I was very fortunate to sing all those commercials, and I was singing jingles when the Archies came along, and they wanted me to be the lead singer of the Archies. Sugar Sugar was also the Applebee's commercial a few years ago, and it's amazing how the music communicates with people.
How were you instructed back in the day, Ron, when they wanted a certain sound? You know, were they saying, try to get inside the head of a 22-year-old, you know, whatever, eater, drinker, driver, or did you just did they just count on you to catch the feeling of that moment?
Well, it was. I was a 22-year-old. I was a 20-year-old. So, I, when I sang, they liked my sound. They liked the sound that I made. That's why I was the top jingle singer in New York, tenor, for many, many years, 15 years. The human voice communicates better than almost anything for selling things and for communicating to other humans. So it's been the true all these years from the 30s till today. And they never directed me. They just said, well, we like your sound. Here's the song. They put a lead sheet in front of me and they say, make it sound real. Make it sound like what's on the radio. The years I started seeing commercials, the advertising on Madison Avenue decided that they had to catch up to pop radio.
Couldn't sound like the old coffee commercials anymore, something distinct and different that had to sound more like the mainstream.
Exactly. They wanted something that sounded like was pop music that was on the radio anymore. They, before that, it was Mitch Miller, and it was the very homogenized sound, very articulate singing. Everybody made sure the words came through perfectly.
Yep.
When my generation of jingle singers came about, they let us be a little more rock and roll, a little more pop in our approach to their commercials, and it worked.
And here's the moment, 1969, when you, Ron Dante, were lead singer as it went right over onto the pop charts, Sugar Sugar.
I just can't believe the loveliness of loving you.
I just can't believe it's true.
I just can't believe the wonder of this feeling too.
I just can't believe it's true.
Ah, sugar.
Tim Taylor, is this the moment when the dam broke? Was Ron Dante the guy who drove the car through the breach?
Oh, yeah. Ron was important with his shift. And that's when it happened. It was the counterculture became so powerful that if you were in the advertising or really any industry, you had to decide if you were going to get on the bus or get out of the way. And, you know, a lot of people decided to go with the flow.
Ron, did other jingle singers, were they amazed that you'd gone over to the pop charts themselves, or did it just seem like a natural jump?
Well, I think it was an amazing time because it had not happened that often. And I remember sitting singing on the microphone for some commercials, and the fellas next to me, the new people coming in to sing commercials, were people like Michael Bolton, Luther Vandross, Valerie Simpson from Ashford and Simpson, Melissa Manchester. They were all training, kind of, making a little money, extra money, and then they were going to go on and have careers.
Yeah.
And they all went on and became part of the pop culture. It was amazing. I even met a fellow named Barry Manilow singing a commercial. and look what happened to him.
Became totally, totally huge, Barry Manilow. What, out of the same background of singing commercials and then before his pop success?
Yes, we were all jingle singers in the pen, being called upon to sing commercials for different things. And I remember the dam really broke when Barry went out with his first hit record and he needed something that people would recognize for the rest of his act. So we concocted, I ended up producing Barry for about 10 years. We did a jingle medley that incorporated all the commercials he had sung on and been a part of, and it was the biggest hit of his act, and that's really when the dam broke.
I think I've got a little bit of that right here. Ron Dante, please stand by in L.A. It's great to have you. Timothy Taylor, The Sounds of Capitalism is his book. And here's that moment, Barry Manilow, a little undated video on YouTube, where he's suddenly regaling a concert audience with a medley of old jingles that made him as much a success as his pop tunes. We're talking about music and commerce in America. What do you think about the way these two have flowed together? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
So
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about music and commerce in America, how advertising has moved in on American popular music, not least with Revolution by the Beatles. 1987, even those gods of pop music, the Beatles, who didn't sell their catalog to iTunes until 2 years ago. By 87, they had licensed this iconic song of the counterculture revolution to the sneaker company, Nike. That was a change. We're well into it now. Timothy Taylor describes a better part of a century of that evolution in his new book, The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ron Dante's with us as well, singer, songwriter, session vocalist, record producer. Sugar Sugar, he had number one selling record of the year in 1969 after he came over from the world of jingles. You can join us. Can music challenge the way we live, really speak to our hearts when it's made into marketing? Is there any song that won't be repurposed to sell stuff, to sell soap? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. April is calling from Evansville, Indiana. Hi, April. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Love your show.
Thank you.
I absolutely love commercials. I'm crazy like that. But I remember growing up and on our road trips with my family, on vacation trips, we would actually sing the jingles and try and guess what the products were. So it actually became a big game for us as a family, and there was always new jingles and new products out there, so we always had an endless variety of things to sing, but it kind of made the time pass by quickly, and it just stuck in my mind, and so even today, I really love watching commercials.
So. Boy, it's just right in the middle of the culture, and you're right. You and many others, April. I mean, our minds are kind of jukebox of these things, and the jingles pop out, and by go the miles in your case. But I have to say, there was a time when I did not expect a lot of this music to become marketing, but there it is. Thanks, April. Let me get one more. Jim in Boston, you're on the air, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to, first of all, thank Dr. Taylor for being on the show. I've read some of his books before, and so I'd like to ask him a question.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm kind of curious about what the motivation for the bands like the Rolling Stones and then eventually U2 for actually getting into that the advertising where they hadn't before.
Is it just money? Is it as simple as that, Tim? Or you know, when you were as big as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, why do it?
It's partly money, but it's also partly because this will sound kind of mundane, but it's really partly because of the passage in 1996 of the Communications Act of 1996, which made it possible for a single entity to own own radio stations in the same market and in the same format. So if you were, you know, a big company like CBS, you could own all the rock stations in Cincinnati if you wanted to,
mm-hmm.
Which was illegal before. And what that meant was that a lot of stations got bought up by only a few corporations. Most rock stations now are owned by only three different corporations. And like any big corporations, you know, to sort of streamline things and save money, they streamlined their playlists. So almost overnight, starting, you know, 96, it became a lot harder for musicians to get their music played on the radio. And, you know, even if you're a big, you know, a major act like the Rolling Stones or U2, you still want, you know, you need radio airplay because that's how people learn about your new recordings. And so letting your music be used in commercials became a way of getting your music out there if it wasn't getting on the radio.
It was a way to get through that wall of sameness that came to music. I mean, Ron, take us back. There's an important thesis in Tim Taylor's book that, you know, that music was supposed to have a kind of or it was seen as having a role of resistance or otherness from the mainstream consumer culture, but it's kind of merged with that and in some ways turned us from citizens into what we're now often described as consumers. Do you worry about that, Ron? Music is powerful stuff.
I never worried about that. It just seemed a natural progression that people would use music to sell products, And it seemed like a natural progression. Well, look at all the T-shirts and clothing that we wear that has brands on it. We never had that for years. It was just that something that happened because the music is so much a part of everybody's life in so many ways. They change their moods with it, and it never bothered me. I always thought great writers and singers and producers are making music, and they're not doing it a lot of times for the commercial possibilities, but for the artistic possibility. And what it's used for after it takes a life of its own. Somebody writes a great song. I don't think Carly Simon thought Anticipation would end up a ketchup commercial, but it did. She wrote it with her heart, and she wanted to make a great vocal recording with it.
And it's still happening. I mean, here's Nick Drake, songwriter, dead many years before his gentle songs got a kind of cult following. Then, 1999, Volkswagen plugged into Drake with an ad showing young people driving to a party on a beautiful night, pulling into the noisy driveway, then pulling back out onto the quiet road with Milky Way. And suddenly, Nick Drake's beautiful Milky Way is selling Volkswagens. Timothy Taylor, can music do both things? Can a song sell soap or cars and simultaneously really speak to the deep human heart? Or, you know, does it move it onto a different track once it's used in this way?
Well, I think most people would say, it's moved onto a different track. I mean, if it's a pre-existing song, when Nike used Beatles' Revolution in 1987, a lot of people were really unhappy about it. The remaining Beatles tried to sue Nike, even though they didn't own their own music anymore. They'd sold it to Michael Jackson by that point. But they were so angry at what was seen as, kind of violation of what the song was about. But a lot of those attitudes have diminished. Now I think most people probably think it's cool to hear, a contemporary song in a commercial, whereas, like in the Beatles case, it wasn't thought of as cool at all.
But everybody's doing it. The hit called The Fun by the Wise Guys. It is just 2001 ad, shows beautiful people dancing, grooving in the seats of their Mitsubishi. Get a call from Cam in Boston. Cam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Well, I think that, if you're writing music specifically for a corporation, that's one thing. But if you wrote a song and then after the fact sell it, then I think it slightly cheapens it in some ways because, you aren't thinking about Nike shoes when you're writing a song. You're thinking about however it makes you feel.
Are you in the biz, Cam? Are you writing songs? Do you think about their commercial potential while you're writing them?
Well, I'm not in the biz. I'm a student at Berklee College of Music. And, I just try to think about reaching a unique audience with my songs. I mean, I think that music, the special thing about music is when you write something that sounds really unique and it resonates with people, and, they feel like it doesn't sound like every other song they hear. I mean, that to me is what's special about music.
Ron Dante speak to that, that there were and remain, thank heavens, artists who really want to write from the heart. Their song is about their feelings. That's why it connects with us. Now, you came out of jingles, so you had product in mind as you were singing those songs, and everybody did. Do you see that there's something that maybe we need to keep separate here, Ron? That maybe
Absolutely. Also, a lot of the songwriters who write these great songs are now keeping tabs on it. And any time a product wants to use them, mm-hmm. they get the call from the publisher and they say, so-and-so would like to use your song. And they have the right to say, no, I do not want it used in this type of commercial, this type of product. So there's a lot more control going on than used to be. And I think that's good because if you write a certain song, you do not want it used in something that is completely anti what you wrote about. So there are restraints being put on things today. I agree that you have to be very careful with your material. You don't want your mm-hmm. great heartfelt song used for something that is not proper.
On the other hand, many have been. And Tim, you suggest in the book that this has happened so much now that it's really crept even into the composition phase for many musicians. I mean, it's hard to not be aware of the sales potential that music has beyond that first heartfelt impulse, Tim.
Yeah, well, especially if you can't count on radio airplay for your song. You know, the measure of success for a lot of musicians today is not record sales as measured in the Billboard magazine charts, but you know, did their song get picked up for use in a commercial? Did it get picked up for use in a TV show or a film? You know, I mean, that's what matters to a lot of musicians today. I take what Ron says seriously, but, you know, unfortunately, a lot of musicians don't own their own music. You know, it's owned by their record company or somebody else, so some of them don't have control over what happens to their music. Some do. And like Ron says, you know, they're exercising control over it.
I mean, Mark writes to us here on Facebook, says, I don't see what choice artists have nowadays, given the way the music market has changed, given how hard it is to get radio play and all the rest. And here's back to your big theme. Daniel writes, so Daniel Gewirtz, a journalist, I guess, says, when jingles lost favor and the famous songs of our culture took over in commercials, the anthems of a previous generation, he says it was a movement to usurp the meaning of a society, the tokens of social statement, generational wisdom. It was capitalism not only becoming more important than pop culture, but purposefully diminishing the power of pop culture. What do you say to that, Tim? You use the word conquest right in your culture. That deliberate? Right in your title, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the advertising industry, more than in other countries, the advertising industry in this country is hugely, hugely powerful, and you know they control most of the media that we have contact with. And you know, if we just think back again to the Communications Act of 1996, you know, it's no longer radio DJs who are deciding what, you know, cool music is going to be heard on the radio for the most part. It's somebody in an advertising agency is just saying, oh, well, I like that song. Let's put that in a commercial. So they are making those choices about, you know, the music that we hear in a commercial, or, you know, music that we might hear in a TV show, rather than a DJ, you know, in whom people used to put their trust for, you know, picking music that they might like.
Peter on Cape Cod is calling. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask your speaker to comment on the role of commercials with independent or unknown artists and the commercial really launching their careers when a song gets played on a commercial. Like, you hear a commercial and it's got a catchy song and you go and you look it up right away and it's not a popular artist endorsing a product, but it's an unknown artist.
Yeah, I mean, this is often the dynamic now, isn't it, Peter? That may be how you first get introduced to them. Tim Taylor, I guess that's what you're describing right here, is it's somebody in the marketing realm who says, that might be good behind our product. There it goes. The next thing you know, that artist has exposure, but it's come through the commercial side of exposure.
Yeah, and a lot of people in the industry, they pride themselves on this. I mean, they see themselves as introducing new bands, you know, new music to the public that the public wouldn't have heard any other way. You know, they're not hearing it on the radio, unless they listen to college radio, you know, but they're not hearing it on mainstream radio. And so the ad industry takes pride in the fact that they are playing the role that was once played by, you know, the famous DJs of the past.
What's the implication here for our understanding of ourselves? Music goes very deep into our psyche. What's the implication of this long drift that you're describing?
Well, you know, For the better part of a century, we've been living in an increasingly commercialized culture, a culture increasingly defined by consumption. You know, we are no longer primarily an agricultural or industrial economy. We're a consumer economy, which everybody knows to some extent. I mean, you know, you only have to turn on the news or read the paper to see that, you know, if consumer confidence is down or consumer spending is down, then the whole economy suffers. And, you know, the advertising industry plays a huge role in that. And I think that, you know, it's too bad that, you know, our purchase of things and our relationship to things seems to be as important or maybe more important than our relationships to each other sometimes.
Ron Dante, you were there in the heart of that as the kind of transition happened. Do you think there's any pulling back here? Do we keep something, I don't know if sacred's the right word, but apart, or does it all meld together in our media age, Ron?
I think we're going in cycles. And the golden age of jingle writing and commercials that sold products will come back again, and people will start to write original things to sell products because we'll become inundated with the known songs. I think someday, this may be wishful thinking, but commercials, the great commercials and jingles of the past will be revered as hit songs. And people will go to museums to listen to them and see them and see a piece of American history in these commercials, such as You've Got a Lot to Live campaign of 1970, which is one of the best campaigns ever put together, film and music.
And the non-commercial side of this, will it ever be really non-commercial again, Ron?
I there will always be pockets of great artists creating something new and different. And they will emerge, and there'll be new technology that will deliver them to us. That's what I feel.
Ron Dante, singer, songwriter, session vocalist, jingle guy, and Sugar Sugar on his playlist. Ron, thank you so much for joining us from L.A.
It's been my pleasure, and what a great subject matter for a show.
Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you very much. And Timothy Taylor, the book is The Sounds of Capitalism, Advertising, Music, and the Conquest of Culture. You open our eyes and our ears, Tim. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll go out with one more. French-Israeli singer, songwriter Yael Naim, who found popular success when Apple Computer picked up this song, New Soul, to push its MacBook Air. There it is. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.